Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, from July 11th, 2017. This Tuesday's talk and Sangha discussion is the second of three talks on the Eightfold Path. This talk is on right speech, right action, and right livelihood, the virtuous factors of the path. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. Thank you. Peace. So just to put this in context, I'll talk about right view and right intention again. The Buddha, when he gave his first teaching, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, you know how I like saying that word. I say it every time I can. In that, he explained the Eightfold Path as part of the Four Noble Truths. It's the fourth noble truth, the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. And then there's a later sutta called the Magavabhanga Sutta, which is called the analysis of the path, where he gets into a little bit more detail. And that's in the new book, by the way. So right view implies that there's such a thing as wrong view. Another word for wrong view is a view that's rooted in ignorance. You remember that the Buddha awakened to the truth that it is ignorance through 12 observable causative links that all manner of confusion, delusion, and suffering arises. And that suffering is called dukkha in Pali, which means anything from mild disappointment and the general unsatisfactory nature to life all the way to extreme mental and physical suffering. And I guess you could put spiritual suffering in there if you want to use the word. And so he needed to come up with a way to go from that view rooted in ignorance to a view that is a right view, or a view that is deeply informed from wisdom, from right understanding. And a significant component of ignorance is the need for continued ignorance, in other words, to ignore that which you're ignorant of in order to maintain that ignorance. That's called selfing. That's this strategy that we've all created to continue maintaining a self. The second noble truth says a craving for experiential existence and clinging to that existence once an identity is made over that experience continues suffering. Second noble truth. So right intention then is the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging in all its forms. So I'm giving this lead up to the virtuous factors to show how incredibly practical the Eightfold Path is. The Buddha identifies the problem as wrong view, and now he's giving us a way to develop right view. He recognized that it is wrong intention, the intention to maintain a self-referential ego personality, as the problem. And now he's giving us a way to recognize in a very practical and direct way that ego personality through the virtuous factors of right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And how incredibly practical is that? It's in our thought, words, and deeds that we continue to express and maintain an ego personality, isn't it? I want this, I want that, I don't like this, I don't like that, they're wrong, I'm right. All speech and action that we do, and the subtle underlying aspect of that is this constant story that we're telling about ourselves to ourselves. Remember the Buddha describing that feedback loop that he got caught up in, that he finally recognized, of self-referential views being stuck in that consciousness that's rooted in ignorance. There was no way out of it. That's what we're all stuck in. When we find aspects of the Dhamma difficult to understand, it's not that the Dhamma is difficult, it's that we have that veil of ignorance that's insisting that we ignore what's right in front of us. It's surprising, well, not anymore, but it was surprising initially when I started teaching, how many people recognize their eye-making first through right speech, through what was coming out of their mouth. And an important aspect of right speech, probably the most important aspect of right speech, is what we're telling ourselves. And that's one of the reasons why meditation is so effective. When our minds start to quiet, the last 4 weeks we've been talking about the Satipatthana Sutta. Initially, the Buddha's teaching meditation to quiet your mind first so you can start recognizing what you're saying to yourself. Feelings arise, we react to that. Thoughts arise, we react to that. That's a very clear way of looking at the story we're telling ourselves and using that story to continue eye making. So let me just read the Buddha's. I'm not going to read the whole article. I'll just touch on a few parts of this. The Buddha's words, when the mind is inclined towards the Dhamma, the disciple of the noble ones gains a sense of the goal. In other words, you understand where we're going with this. They gain a sense of the Dhamma. They gain joy connected with the Dhamma. We talked about this maybe Saturday or last Thursday. When we finally realize what we found here in these teachings that are 2,600 years old, joy really should be a part of it. We found a simple and direct way out. We found the path that people have been looking at or looking for forever. And here it is right in front of us. And it's still useful and it's still effective today. It still applies, hence the word noble truths. These truths stand the test of time. They're as applicable today and as useful today as they were 2,600 years ago. And one who is joyful, rapture arises. And that's kind of a misunderstood word. And it's kind of maybe a little bit of an ancient word. In this sense, rapture just means that we're fully enveloped in the Dhamma. It truly has become the framework for our life. In one who is rapturous, the body grows calm. Why does the body grow calm? Because we know we're going in the right direction. We've taken, this is another aspect of taking true refuge. Refuge is a place of comfort and safety. When you recognize that you found a refuge, we found a refuge in the Dhamma, we will be calm. Even though we know there's still work to do, and there's still going to be agitation along the way. We're taking refuge in the Dhamma. That's what the Buddha is referring to here. One whose body is calmed experiences ease. That doesn't mean that we stop living life. It means we stop having self-referential experiences. When we're calm, when we're not reacting to life as life occurs. How do we know when we're reacting? Through being mindful of our speech, our actions, and our livelihood. In what at ease, the mind becomes concentrated. Going right back to the need for meditation, but also pointing to the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path. That's from the Anguttara Nikaya, if anybody's interested. I just want to read the Buddha's words on right speech, right action, right livelihood. Right speech is abstaining from lying, speaking truthfully. Abstaining from divisive speech, including gossip, speaking with compassion for all. Abstaining from abusive speech, speaking with kindness and tolerance. Abstaining from idle chatter, speaking only what is necessary and helpful. Now, you also remember when we went through that series on restraint, a few times the Buddha said to be mindful of self-effacing speech, meaning to employ it. And when we're not using self-effacing speech, to be mindful of that and start using self-effacing speech. And ultimately, what we're talking about is not intentionally not inserting I in our speech, but not even having it come up. Is that understandable? We engage in the world in such a manner that we're no longer defending or promoting a self in our speech. That's self-effacing speech. Imagine the peace and calm that follows from that. When we no longer have to interject ourselves into everything. And we can take that to extremes. Like, well, how do I order dinner? That's not what the Buddha's talking about. The Buddha's talking about a quality of mindfulness that is free of the, he uses this term often, free of the burden of self, free of the need to continue to maintain a self-referential ego self that is rooted in ignorance and prone to disappointing and confusing experiences. Again, it's the sole purpose of the Buddha's Dhamma. In speaking of right action, he says, right action is abstaining from taking life, remaining harmless to all beings. Let me go back a couple paragraphs in the article. The Buddha, when talking about developing the Eightfold Path, he talks about it in tasks to accomplish. And so as far as a task to accomplish of right speech is to be mindful of wrong speech and enter and remain in right speech. Isn't that remarkable? You know, we talked about that in the Satipatthana Sutta. Actually, we didn't get to that part on Saturday. We're going through that series where he talks about mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. This is what he's talking about. Directly implementing the Eightfold Path. And how do we do it? Through mindfulness. Why is concentration necessary? So that we can hold in mind, so we're well concentrated enough to hold in mind the proper application of mindfulness. And this is one example of that. Be mindful when you're engaged in wrong speech and enter and remain in right speech. a direct and practical way of developing the Dhamma. In fact, it's the only way to develop the Dhamma, through mindfulness. We can't do it through concepts. And much of adapted Buddhism, meaning what's followed from the Buddhist teachings, is conceptual. In other words, a Buddha is loving and mind and compassionate all the time, so we should be loving and compassionate. Well, we can't do it unless we understand the underlying cause why we're not compassionate and loving all the time or honest all the time, because we still have that component of eye-making. But if we can be mindful of or the eye-making, then we can diminish it, and we will naturally be Buddhas. We will become Buddhas, hence the name of the new book that I'll talk about in a little while. Be mindful of wrong speech and enter and remain in right speech. Now the Buddha talks about right action. Abstaining from taking life, remaining harmless to all beings. And so that's a direct admonition against taking another human being's life, isn't it? But he's also tying this in with right speech, or we should at least acknowledge the tie. How often do we commit character assassination against people? Take another's life through destroying their reputation or belittling them in some way. And I'm not saying that we in this room do this constantly, but I bet you every one of us has done it at least once in our life. Why should we be mindful of it? Because it's hurtful towards ourselves, and it's certainly hurtful towards others. It certainly contributes to the common suffering in the world when we engage in hurtful rhetoric, isn't it? When we try to assassinate somebody's character through the words we use. That's an aspect of wrong action, and also part of wrong speech. Abstaining from taking what is not freely given, taking only what is offered. Simple and direct, isn't it? Abstaining from sexual misconduct, acting with generosity and kindness, which is an overall theme of the entire Dhamma, isn't it? To act with great generosity. An expression of selflessness is acting with great generosity. And it's not a magnanimous gesture to give someone something if you're making note of how much you're giving, if you're aware of it. But true giving has no attachment to it. You're not losing anything, are you? You're not giving up anything. You're not sacrificing anything. And that's true what the Buddha's talking about here. He never said that we should not engage in sexual relations. There is monastic rules that develop that, but it has nothing to do with the Eightfold Path. But he does say, in all of our relationships, and certainly in those relationships, we should be mindful and generous, not trying to just satiate desire. And imagine that. Imagine how wonderful all our sexual relationships would be if they're always like that. Abstaining from selfish acts, acting for the good of all. The most selfless act we can take is to take to the Dhamma and awaken. Because it will always be acting in selflessness. That's right action. The Buddha says how to develop right action is to be mindful of wrong action and enter and remain in right action. Again, speaking to that proper application of mindfulness. Simply be mindful. That's why the Buddha is teaching these virtuous aspects. This is where the Buddhist teachings get have a religious connotation, because nearly every religion, not everyone, teaches morals as its foundation. And so here's some moral and ethical teachings. And it's not that in a general way we should be moral and ethical. We should. But in a very specific and practical way, it's when we're acting non-virtuous and not with non-virtuous behavior that we can clearly recognize eye-making. That's why the Buddha taught it in a very simple way. Three factors there: right speech, right action, and right livelihood. If we're mindful of that, we will know on a continual basis where we're continuing eye-making, where we're continuing to contribute to our own confusion, delusion, and suffering. Is that clear? Is it understandable why the Buddha taught this way? Is it understandable why he taught an Eightfold Path in this way? Somebody tell me why.
It's very practical.
Why do they call it a practice? I mean, that's the best use of the word practice, isn't it? Because it's so practical. Okay. I didn't mean to be cute there.
A continuous test of your right view and right intention.
Absolutely, Ron. And that's a good word to use for it, the test. The Buddha often said, when he's describing a wise person, someone who is really developing the Dhamma, he said they are aware of even the slightest, sometimes he used the word danger, taking the slightest license with any of this, meaning right speech, right action, and right livelihood, aware of the slightest danger. And where does the danger fall? I mean, it can fall on society, and it often does, but it affects us directly, and it continues our confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering.
Because the slightest misstep you make is more eye-making.
More eye-making, and it's and it continues karma, and not in that punishing view of karma.
Mm-hmm.
It just continues karma as an ongoing experience of dukkha. Another way of saying that is it continues the five clinging aggregates, the personal experience of dukkha.
The loop. It continues the loop.
Yes, that feedback loop that the Buddha talks about in his awakening.
Isn't another sort of translation of the second factor of the Eightfold Path, right, resolve?
Yep.
So that word sort of has a little bit more, you know, forthrightness. You know,
mm-hmm.
Intention is a
mm-hmm.
nice thing,
mm-hmm.
concept, but in reality, you know, what Ram is saying, it's a constant, you know, it takes some guts to kind of keep this
it,
up.
It does.
Resolve.
It takes a strong resolve.
Discipline, it's a different type of, word. It's interesting.
To
keep your practice going, right?
Exactly. In some translations, they do use the word resolve.
Sorry.
Yes?
I was going to say, and in terms of when you were saying, you know, kind of linking together concentration and mindfulness and intention and view and all this, and it's very... our speech and our actions are the outward manifestation of right resolve. It takes it out of the moralistic framework because we're not interested in good and bad. They may be, but we're interested in letting go of clinging and craving. And then, you know, often virtuous behavior results as a result of that.
Yes.
But it's not moralistic, and it's not, you know, theistic, and it's not, you said, you know, we'll get some reward or not. It's completely devoid of that, because it's just, did I further clinging and craving, or was I able to develop restraint and let go of that? And therefore, there can be no, you did this and I did that and she shouldn't have avoided it, because it just wouldn't be there if you stay on one and two.
There's no more, you don't need to keep score because there's nothing to keep score about.
Yeah.
There's nothing of significance that has been done or that we're letting go of, except we're ultimately the whole point is to become empty of ignorance and to recognize where that ignorance, through being mindful of wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood, we're looking directly at the results of ignorance. And what is right view? Right view is a view that is devoid of ignorance, a view that is imbued with great wisdom. Let me touch on right livelihood. Follows in the same theme. Abstaining, right livelihood is abstaining from dishonesty, profiting from virtuous acts. Abstaining from hurtful endeavors, contributing to the common good. So, at first that could sound pretty confining until you realize that there's a lot of things that we can do that contribute to the common good that aren't necessarily, it doesn't necessarily mean we have to be spreading the Dhamma everywhere. If we're landscapers, I don't know why I'm thinking of you, Helen, I'm sorry. If we're landscapers, planting a beautiful garden is contributing to the common good. If we're teachers, teaching with integrity is contributing to the common good. And again, I'm sorry, I'm talking about people directly, I don't mean that. Whatever we're doing, as long as the end result is harmless to people, and we're doing it with the integrity that's framed by the Eightfold Path, we can't help but contribute to the common good. Because we're all in this together in that sense, aren't we? Whatever we do in that sense, if it's done mindfully framed by the Eightfold Path, it has to contribute to the common good. I know you've heard me talk about this. There's great freedom that comes when we finally realize that we don't have to be concerned with our actions when we know that our actions flow from the Eightfold Path. We know that we've done everything we can to put a check on this thing called self. There's incredible, I mean, that is the ultimate freedom. It relates to the Vitakasanthana Sutta, where the Buddha said we gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it. We gain the ability to act however we want to act, whenever we want to act, because we know it's pure. We know there's no hurtful motivation at all in it. And imagine, I was going to say, if this spreads, imagine as it spreads over the planet. I mean, it's taken 2,600 years, but it'll continue to spread. Imagine if everybody is self-effacing in their thoughts, words, and deeds.
I like using the word harmless in this as well, because I think it's a very general test, again, that you can put to both your speech and your actions.
Yes, and to be mindful of it in that way. Is what I'm doing completely harmless to others and myself? Completely. And there's such incredible freedom from that, from understanding that, yes, it is. And it's not, and this is not something that's impossible. The Buddha didn't teach anything that's impossible. In fact, there's no reason to not do it if we really want to live a life of peace and contentment. More?
So, shorthand, is it helping or selfing?
Yeah. What's up there? So the task associated with that, be mindful of wrong livelihood and enter and remain in right livelihood, just like the task associated with the other two. Simply to be mindful of it. In fact, you could say, and we're going to talk more about this on Saturday, and the reason I'm saying that is the talks will be posted. The first four are already up. You could say that in that way, gentle mindfulness is really the key. But remember, mindfulness means to recollect or to hold in mind. And we can hold in mind anything. We can hold in mind principles that have nothing to do with the Eightfold Path, even though they may be wholesome in some way. And that's great. We can also hold in mind things that are very hurtful towards ourselves and towards the world. So we have to be careful what we hold in mind. Again, that's why the Buddha taught mindfulness that way. To hold in mind the factors of the Eightfold Path. And for this week's talk, to be mindful of right speech, right action, and right livelihood. There's just one more thing that I want to read. If I find it. It's just a mention of, again, the Ratana Sutta, and I touched on it earlier, that's taking true refuge. We take refuge in the Buddha, that a human being actually did this. In his Dhamma, that he showed others. He left his teachings for us, the Dhamma. We take refuge in that. This isn't something that, you know, came out of Mad Comics or something, or some vague, probably too, so I'm sorry for that silly reference, or some kind of vague philosophical system. We know where it came from. It came from a guy that actually did it, and he's teaching others how to do it. And that third refuge, that I say this so often, we're so fortunate to have what's developed here in Frenchtown. A sangha that is this well focused on what the Buddha actually taught. It really is remarkable. So that's the talk. I wanted to touch on one other thing that kind of came up while I was thinking about this talk yesterday. I very rarely listen to music, and not that I have anything against it. More, you know, we lived together for a few years. It's just not something I engage in. I usually find when I'm doing it, it's distracting to me. But I got a song in my head the other day, and I just wanted to listen to it again. You'll learn a little bit too much about my past by me telling you this, but I'm going to say it anyway. It was a song by the Highwaymen. Does everybody know who the Highwaymen are? Willie Nelson, Merle Haggard, Johnny, the coolest man that ever lived, Johnny Cash, and Chris Christopherson. Johnny Cash is the coolest man that ever lived, because he had an incredible voice. He could sing just amazingly well without ever moving his mouth. And he could dance without ever moving his feet. The definition of the coolest man that's ever lived, besides his black clothes.
No views there.
No views. That's just a clear, mindful observation. The song was City of New Orleans, and that really doesn't matter, but I decided to listen to it, and I found it on YouTube, and I listened to it, and it just started bringing back. There was a lot to me with that song for a lot of reasons that aren't important, but it really brought me back through my life. I'm almost 600 years old now. I feel I'm 61 years old now, so I've had a lot of incredible experiences. I've had some awful things happen to me, and I won't get into them. Every human life has tragedies, and we have great, incredible moments. It's all part of dukkha, with how the Buddha described dukkha. But putting it in the context of the Eightfold Path and these moral and ethical, the virtuous factors, made me realize what an incredible place we have, an incredible opportunity to experience awakening in. Every single moment of our lives holds the potential to appreciate deeply what's occurring, no matter what it is, in awakening. And along the way, we get to have the greatest adventure anyone could possibly imagine, living a human life. Am I overemphasizing this or over-exaggerating it, does it seem? Because I don't mean to. And really what this was leading up to when I started thinking more about this is often the Dhamma is seen as nihilistic or at least negative. It's always focused on suffering and blah, blah, blah. It's just such nonsense. We have to look at the problem if we're going to end the problem. But underlying that is right view. And right view is, holy crap, this is incredible. We get to awaken, excuse the language. And we know how to do it. We don't have to waste our time doing other things. We can get to it. We can understand the real meaning of life. What is it? Why are we here? The Dalai Lama said it best, even though I don't agree with a lot of what he says lately, but that's okay. He said the purpose of time is to awaken. That's why we're here. That's the most important thing. If we want to live lives of lasting peace and contentment, right here, right now, in this life, using the Buddha's words, we should take to it like our head's on fire. What's more important? Instead of being distracted by dukkha, you know, you heard me say often, the biggest problem with dukkha is the preoccupation that we have with dukkha because of eye-making. We miss this entire adventure called human life because we're preoccupied with solving dukkha rather than eliminating ignorance, becoming empty of ignorance. That was what the Buddha awakened to. He looked out around. Remember the Nagara Sutta? And he looked out. He described looking out on the world around him. The world is aflame. People are aflame. Aflame with passion. The need to continue eye-making. And then he figured it out. Develop right view through right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood. Engage with right effort and develop right mindfulness rooted in right concentration. So we'll talk about those last two factors next week. But I think that's the talk today. Thank you. Okay. Did I go off too much on that? My own little loving life rant, but it really is incredible. So let's if you have any questions, is there any questions or comments related directly to the talk? And then we'll go around the room. Ron, good to see you tonight. How's your practice going?
Nothing really to add. Meditation's going along, getting easier. My goose is calming down. It now sits next to my chart and meditates.
Great. We need a picture of that. Thank you. That's great. Kevin, good to see you.
Good to see you. Good to see everybody. Yeah, I don't think I have much to add either. Just really appreciative of the Sangha for the support. Practice has been consistent. The Dhamma study part could be better, but I'm still grateful for seeing things more clearly. So, thank you.
Good to see you. That right resolve, there's a word, Pali word, kshanti, kshanti, which means patient forbearance. It's a patient. Just be patient with ourselves, but keep going. Good to see you, Kevin. Matt, good to see you.
Good to see you, John.
Welcome back.
Good to see everybody. Thanks. I thought about all of you a lot the past couple weeks. Not a lot to add. Practice has been good, consistent, and very helpful. Just thinking about that feedback loop and what we've been talking about tonight, and what the Eightfold Path is for, as a way to purify the feedback loop.
Yeah.
And this sort of addiction with self to purify that constant self-referential stream with right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right idea, right mindfulness, right concentration. Because that's what we have while we're here. We have just a thing that goes like this, so it can be running around in ignorance, ignorant of our own clinging, or we can reframe it, contextualize it in our lives, in what we're saying, what we're thinking, what we're saying about what we're thinking, and no religion necessary at that point. There's no need for something conceptual, because it's all happening here, in how we're living, in
moment by moment.
Moment by moment.
Yeah.
So yeah, my brain's still pretty scrambled from my experience the past couple weeks, but good to be home.
It's good to have you home. Thank you, Matt. Matt and I have both referenced the Nagara Suttas. Most of you know what that is, but it's the sutta where the Buddha describes his awakening, and it's remarkable. It's on the website if you want to read it, but he describes this feedback loop. Another way of describing that is thinking rooted in ignorance. Another way of describing that is deluded thinking. And so how do you know if you're stuck in ignorance and you're stuck in deluded thinking? How do you know you are? Well, the beginning of right view is accepting that maybe you are and taking some measures to figure that out. And that's where the Eightfold Path comes into play. The Buddha, upon his awakening, sat for a few more weeks thinking, how can I teach what I know to get past that common human problem of deluded thinking, of conditioned thinking? And that's where the Eightfold Path comes into play. Without it, there's no way of piercing that veil of ignorance. Keith, good to see you tonight. How you doing, my friend?
Good to see you. I'm doing well. I've been taking a vacation in ignorance lately. Just had a lot of exciting things going on and a lot of things coming up, and I just find myself completely preoccupied with things that already happened and things that are going to happen, and I have completely lost touch with where I'm at the moment.
Yeah.
And so what you were talking about when you were listening to that song really brings me to where I'm at right now. But my practice is getting back on track. That's the first thing that goes, and everything else follows. It's just a snowball. But as I get back on track with my practice, it all comes back together, and I feel like I'm starting to rain in, so I'm very happy to be here and happy to see everybody, so thank you.
Thank you, I'm glad you're here. Just another experience in impermanence, isn't it? Even Dhamma practices that way. Glad you're here. Natalie, good to see you again.
Good to see you too. Liking here with zero reluctance, because I initially, this past couple of months, been kind of messy, so the past few weeks I've been meditating a lot more.
Oh, good.
And doing a lot of clearing work and following things back deep into my childhood self and feeding that child lots of love and
good.
Doing a lot of writing and dreaming and journaling all my dreams and tracking where I am in the present moment and really trying to bring the serenity and tranquility into every moment has been a big practice for me lately, and it's been feeling really, really good.
Good for you.
A lot more silent.
Yeah. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm so glad you joined us tonight.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
Hope to see you again soon. Let me go to Mary. Mary, good to see you.
It's good to be here. You know, listening to what you're saying about right action, I don't think I've focused on that as much as I have. You know, some of the other areas and combining that with right speech and the whole idea of, I don't know exactly how it was said, but, you know, when you were your words and your speech aren't there to harm others, you know, no transgressions or something like that. And that's definitely something to think about. You know, I work in a world where words and eye making are like sometimes you got 10 minutes on a call and there's 25 other people on a call and you got to move apart and there's nothing but eye making happening on the call. So it's easy to get caught up in that in order to make your point or complete your task or whatever the you know, whatever the requirement is. So that's something I'm going to take from today and really think more about that. Of course, that's also helpful in my personal life as well. But things have been going very well. You know, I'm on a journey of my youngest getting ready for college and that transition, and it's up and down as a parent. You know, some days I say so much that some days it's awful. Who thought of being a parent would be a great kid, you know? But it's not really awful. I really don't have anything to complain about. But boy, there's nothing like having children to have a mirror up to yourself about when you're not in right view and when don't have, you know, right intention, all of those things when you're just in fear for them or, you know, whatever it is. And so it's very helpful to bring me back to a place of calm. So it's, anyway, it's been up and down the last few weeks, but my practice has been good. And, but I haven't, when I say it's been up and down, I haven't been living it off my cushion as well as I would like to, just because of some transitional things. But I liked what I heard about, you know, right speech and right action. I just sort of heard some things differently tonight. So I think that's something I can go back and do some work about.
Thank you.
So thank you.
Yeah. There's even a Duke of being a mother, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. Just a little.
Just a little. That that mirror, I worked real hard on being that mirror for my mom. poor woman, too.
Yeah.
She actually was going to get Duca tattooed on me, but
it's not even the child's
so
backwards, yeah. It's not even the child's fault, you know? I mean,
it was for me. It was definitely my fault.
But, you know, we come with our lens and our perspective and our mental fabrications and our fears and everything that went right and wrong in our lives, and we're trying to protect our children, and they bring what they bring to the party, and it just gets messy sometimes. Mm-hmm. But nobody's really at fault.
Yeah.
It's all learning and growing.
Yep. Thank you for joining
us tonight.
Jen, good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you. Oh, I'm glad I came tonight. I had a lot of little things that I cherry-picked from the entire evening. And I've been I guess maybe because I'm not working and I have the summer off, I have more time to process, which can be bad, but can be good. There's definitely lots of thoughts up here, and when I'm working, those are just whizzing by, and I'm not watching them as closely as I am now. Sometimes that can be scary when you see them go by. Because since I'm slowing down, my thoughts are slowing down, and I can see entire constructs. Which is good, because I'm seeing my thoughts, and I'm seeing them slow, but sometimes they can be frightening as I watch them go by. And what you said tonight, which I hear you say all the time, we gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it.
Yeah.
For me, I almost have to ignore that statement every time you say it, because that, I immediately grab onto that, and that is, like, I'm clinging to that. Like, I want to be able to think what I want.
I want to get these other things out of my head.
This, you know? And for me, it's really...
I don't think I'll ever say it again.
It's really allowing that. And, you know, I appreciate that the enlightenment is that you are, that actually happens, and that, but the gentle place of just letting thoughts go by and not grabbing onto them is probably more what you know, it is closer for me to being at peace with a less than peaceful mind state. So that's one thing that I cherry-picked tonight. And then the other thing that I liked that you said, that I've also heard you say before, was preoccupation with the solving dukkha.
Yeah.
Like, suck that word in there.
With the what?
Solving of dukkha. Because I'm always trying. That's where I identified this problem, and now I have to figure out how to solve the problem so that I can feel better.
Yeah.
And that's all I know.
And the problem is 5 clinging aggregates. It's not also.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank
you. You said something I was going to comment, but I lost it. So.
Yeah, well, welcome to my world.
It was the description of thoughts flying by and grabbing at them and attaching.
Right.
That is great awareness. Because you're recognizing a self-referential ego self in action. It attaches itself to every thought that occurs. It has to. Every thought has to be a self-referential thought. Or it gets very upset.
Right.
Or confused. Or I don't want to deal with this. Or what's wrong with me? What's wrong with the practice? The Buddha was this.
Mm.
All kinds of excuses.
Yeah.
All taking that way of thinking back to ignorance, needing to ignore what's occurring.
Right,
right,
right.
And there's a whole loop.
Yeah, that's that feedback loop. But it's exhausting. But the freedom in recognizing it. You know, it's. I mean, sometimes we got to fight for our freedom, don't we?
Yeah. But yeah, it is bringing it back to not. What you said in the very beginning, frustration is arising instead of I'm really frustrated.
Yeah. And being at peace with that frustration.
Right.
That's
right.
It's such a key to getting beyond it. We first have to accept that it's there. And accepting that it's there is an aspect of seeing clearly rather than continuing to ignore it.
Mm.
A way that we ignore it is I'm not going to look at it.
Right.
I'm not going to experience it. I can't be frustrated because I'm so wonderfully spiritual. I didn't mean you. I said it because I may have had that thought once or twice myself. I should be beyond this now. Well, if you should be beyond it, you would be, but you're not. Thank you, Jen. Maura, good to see you tonight.
Great to be here. I don't have much to add except that I would say my sitting practice hasn't been a consistent. That's a little frustrating. But I think that just in terms of, so it's not terrible, it's just not as consistent as I find it is helpful, so as effective or helpful. So. But I've been also really just being aware of, just many moments of the day coming back to the breath, to the body, to the felt sensation. So even though my concentration practice isn't as consistent, I'm working a little bit harder during the day, which sometimes, so driving and walking and cleaning and working, and it's just been better, just being aware of kind of felt sensations of aversion and wanting more of, sadness or hurt. I just spent a couple of days with my family, and when you're talking, Mary, about daughters and mothers, and and you guys are mothers. Well, I'm a daughter. I'm a grown daughter, and it's I have a sister and an aunt and these roles, and feelings arise, and being able to kind of just stay with what's arising and seeing it through the lens of allowance and really truly not conceptually but noting the impermanent nature of feeling states and the impersonal nature of feeling states. Has been just kind of more of a focus of my practice, I would say. Really watching that, what Jen, what you had said when you mentioned too, this preoccupation of trying to control and manage. It's just watching that wheel in motion. Oh, what's going on? Oh, you just don't want to feel what you're feeling. You don't want to feel bad and lonely or sad or, and what's proliferating that, and all this such. And that exhaustion of But it's very simple to rein it in and return to the felt sensation. To really experience quite a lot of ease and joy. But there's something, this eye that clings to just wanting to let things be and experience a great freedom. Okay, that's kind of where I'm at.
Thank you. You're kind of describing that same thing. That
yeah.
I want to be free. Gotta go through
yeah,
the,
yeah. And
you gotta
that,
do
it. That limits it right there and then.
Okay.
Right there and then.
Well, but it can provide skillful direction to at least acknowledge
correct.
It. That's where that being at peace with less than peaceful mind states or whatever else it is, being at peace with less than peaceful actions is a part of it too. When you find yourself in wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood, it doesn't do you any good to beat yourself up over it either. Just, and I know you're not,
it's,
I'm just
yes,
talking about.
It's just, like walking around. Not even doing anything much.
Yeah.
You
What happened? There's no me here, and it still hurts. Thank you. Helen, good to see you tonight.
Thank
How are you?
John. Good to be here with everyone. Everyone has so much to offer. And,
yes.
I learn so much from everyone, and I resonate with different people. And last week when I was sitting here, I had the experience of spending time with some high school friends I hadn't seen in many, many years, and meeting new friends through them. And just through various stages in life that people were in and things that were coming up, I could kind of slowly weave things that I've learned sitting on my cushion here into the conversation, and people ask more questions, and I have one friend that's now gone back to meditation, and she's looking for a sangha that she and her husband can go to. And so it felt really good to have that ripple effect. And it's almost easier when it's people you don't have a tight relationship or close relationship with. And so that whole, conditioned behavior or past experiences get in there, and you're not so good at it anymore. Right speech, you catch yourself in wrong speech and wrong view, and it's so much harder sometimes to be consistent when all of these other conditioned things keep coming in. You know, you feel like you've made progress, and
your daughter comes home. Why is that obvious?
There's so many layers to all of this, and every time I sit here, it's like a new layer is peeled open, and I can see things more clearly. And you know, tonight you've heard many times, and many times you do hear. I've heard you say it before, but now I hear you, and so I feel like I've gotten to peel the onion closer and closer and closer. And then every now and then the juice gets in your eye. And you gotta start over again. You gotta get back to that place again. So, but nonetheless, you know, we stand up, we get knocked down, we stand up again. And each time you're just a little bit bruised, but a little bit stronger and a little bit clearer. And, you know, you give yourself a chance to get on the other side of follow the Eightfold Path and get out of that conditioned behavior and try again. So that's what I'm working on.
That's remarkable. Thank you. It really is. Thank you, Helen. Bonnie, good to see you. How are you?
Good to be back. I'm okay. I've been, caught in the loop, being present, and restraint is exhausting. Trying to not do things in a conditioned way, and people really keep you back in it. And it's almost for me to be present and to be quiet and to just be whatever comes up. It's been easier to actually be more in the cave, so to speak. I don't want to only be in the cave, but when I come out, I kind of want to be really clear about how I want to spend my time and how I want to be treated. And then when I hear the thing about eye making, and well, if I didn't have so much of a big old self, then it would not. So it's like as you go into, you keep confronting similar issues on different levels, right? And,
yeah.
I talked about this before, but it's been really, I don't know, maybe when you peel back layers, it can be really painful.
Mm-hmm.
But, like pulling the veil. So trying to, you know, to maintain restraint with right speech, right action. It's been,
good for you.
Really strong going out in the summer.
There's a balancing act, the middle way, you know,
yeah.
Between going into the cave and never coming out,
right.
Which is really
no
being
either.
Detached and isolated,
mm-hmm.
Which is not something
being
the Buddha ever did. But he did he did repeatedly say to go find a secluded spot, and that we should develop seclusion as part of our practice. Remember, he left the palace, wandered around northern India, and finally settled in the woods and spent most of his time removed from the world so he could continue to develop and maintain his well-concentrated mind, but then he would engage in the world when it was appropriate. And that's we have to figure out that balance for ourselves, too. And that's why I always say it's much more easier to develop this in a monastery someplace or in a cave, a true cave setting, than to be actually in the world. But many, many people, when you read the Pali Canon, you know, they awakened while still out in the world. They weren't just monks and nuns that awakened during the Buddhist time. So.
Well, in the monastery, theoretically, everybody's operating with the same framework.
Yes.
Yeah.
The only difference were the rules that the monks...
I'm sure, but all in all, though, I think it just helps me to be even more present in my work, in my livelihood.
Thank you. Liz, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. Good to see everyone. Glad that Natalie's here tonight.
Yeah.
It's really interesting what happens when you have the awareness of all these pathways and truths. And how important sitting in meditation is to be a constant reminder and an opportunity to seek refuge, to reset. That this is not possible without the sitting. And so when I get furthest off track, is when my sitting has fallen off. And, you know, I appreciate the idea of being gentle with yourself, being kind. You can start over again at any point. And then to come to a class like this and be reminded of how everything is sort of stacked together. How it all works together. So that's where I am. I'm reminding myself that it works when you have all the pieces to the puzzle in sort of in your purview.
Yeah.
That you can't do one without the other. So that's why.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you. You're describing the necessity of the middle way. You know, it's this balancing act between meditation and understanding the overall practice that the Buddha taught. He didn't teach just meditation.
Teach the other factors without meditation.
Well, that's right. He taught an eightfold, and he always taught. He never, you know, it's not something that he ever wavered from. Despite, you know, there's some practices that are just meditation, called mind-only schools. There's some schools that are just for scriptural study. Usually not these scriptures. In fact, never these scriptures. There's some that are just deity worship, just be focused on a certain deity. You know, those are common. And they're all wonderful religions. It's not what the Buddha taught. The Buddha taught this middle way. It requires deepening, and he taught meditation for one reason alone: deepen concentration to support the refined mindfulness necessary to hold in mind the Eightfold Path.
And what a relief it is to know that the distractions of mysticism and other layers of Dharma and, you know, I was at this retreat, and I was there for a week, and by the end of the week, I felt like I was back in Catholic school. It was Tibetan, very dogmatic, and rules of doing things certain ways, and by the end of it, I was like, wow. You know, I just really clearly saw that it wasn't. Me. And this process of going back to, you know, to the word of Buddha and how he said it, and how he said it in context with everything else, it's such a relief.
It really is. Yep.
I mean, you know, who's allowed to go to the second story in the stupa, and who's allowed to go to the third level of the stupa? And because I knew the guy that was running, I got to go all the way up to the top. And I'm like, how is this okay? Beautiful artwork, you know, gorgeous, and then some kind of a lightning bolt thing coming through. I don't know what it was. But, you know, it was like, again, it was like a bureaucracy that could bend the rule. You know, and I was like, so much like the Catholic, you know, my interpretation of things within the Catholic Church, things, some things were okay for some and not for others. So this, to me, this middle way, this sort of non-religious, practical practice, that when I get a little wonky, I can go back and I know where I am. And you can just start over. So thank you.
Thank you, Liz. Can I, just a personal question. How did you feel after our retreat?
Oh, great.
And you had some
practice. I figured out the feedback. I was like ready to go home that night. I was like, I got it. I didn't really have it. I thought I had it. It was eye-making, but...
Well, but what...
It was very
what you had was
for me to know that you could interrupt the feedback loop at
yes.
any point. And
yes. You had the beginning of right view. You saw a clear direction to go.
And that the Eightfold yeah. Path is the key to interrupting the feedback loop.
Yeah, that's why he taught it. Yeah. And the most remarkable thing is that those teachings are still here in pure form because of the way they've been preserved. That to me, that's the... To get biblical, that's the greatest story ever told. So. Thank you, Liz. Lorna, good to see you tonight.
Thank you. Good to be here. I have been thinking about sort of a pathway of thought, and it started when I realized, well, when I thought about the word passion. When you started first talking about the word passion, I thought that's a funny thing to pick up on, you know, that word. And I thought, up until now, I thought passion is a good thing. Passion is a driver, passion is a motivator, passion is a, you know. And now I've come to realize that passion equals dukkha. You know, it just equals dukkha. And you can, how the mind works, and it's so gets this passion down to such a fine degree, when you can just say, I prefer a red one or a green one or whatever, you know, I prefer a red apple to a green apple. And you think in life it doesn't really matter. But that word prefer has its roots in passion.
Yeah.
It all roots back to the word passion. And obviously, and you're thinking of an outer and you know the not self-characteristic and how you really do think in life, which is all through an outer thoughts, although it shouldn't be, but we kind of are. mine are anyway. I've observed my mind just how subtle you choose and pick and have preferences to this or to that. All day long it goes on in your head. And I've just sort of realised how subtle it is, to how extreme it can be in going back to the full extreme of passion, but how subtle it can get in everyday things, and just how I scarcely know myself, you know, when I really observe my thinking, I get, how would I be without all this? You know, because it's my driver. My ego drives me what I eat, when I wake up, when I go to bed, what I watch on the telly, what do I eat. Man, it's just overwhelming. And I've not really thought about, you have a saying that, you know, people often say, if I take all this away, I'll be annihilated. That's kind of like washed over me in the past, because I've never felt in danger or uncomfortable with the Dharma teachings, and I thought, I don't know who these people are, but not me. I've always felt comfortable with everything. And I'm beginning to realise just how much an art of thinking that I am thinking through the day. Now, I can now appreciate what the other people are saying. You know, without all this thinking, who would I be? You know, I'd almost change personalities almost, you know. And I've been thinking all about that. That stuff.
So you're really getting to the heart of the matter, though, aren't you? That's the... What happens when you let go of all these self-referential thoughts, when you let go of the story? It feels like annihilation. It feels like there'll be nothing left. The real secret is there's nothing there in the first place.
Yeah.
It's all a story.
I
don't mean to be mystical about that.
Yeah.
Every one of those thoughts that you're having is reinforcing an image that's based on ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that can flow from that is to become increasingly or at least continually ignorant. When you let go of the views, you're simply in an ongoing process as a reference point in time towards what's occurring. And the reason why I'm saying it that way is you don't need it to be any different. It doesn't mean that the next moment might be different. You just don't need it to be any different. If you get the red apple, it's great. If you get a green apple, that's what's there. You know, one doesn't matter. That's true restraint.
And if a bitter feeling arises as a result of eating that?
That feeling doesn't have to drive anything else.
Yeah,
it's just what occurs. Or if you get bad news,
yeah,
you respond appropriately. One of the things that helped me develop a clear understanding of what the Buddha taught are simple stories. Like when he heard that his dad was dying, he didn't say, I'm not a part of it. Nothing affects me. He got up and walked 140 miles to be with his dad before he died. You know, that's what he did. That's what I do. That's what I would do. But it didn't need to be any different. He understands that whole process. I was talking to Matt a little earlier. It's getting a little bit late, so I'll tell the story quickly if I can. When my mom died, it took me a while to put this into perspective. I had that immediate feeling of 1 minute somebody's here and the next minute they're not, even though the body's still here. But you know there's nothing there. There's nothing you can relate to. But it took me a while to realize there was nothing ever to relate to on a permanent basis. She was always in a process of impermanence. And at one point in that continuum, the impermanence took that conscious being away from me. I mean, again, this is not, I didn't think about this when she passed. It took me a while. It took, you know, I need to get perspective. But it also taught me about myself. How could I take myself so seriously? Why have I spent my whole life taking myself so seriously? There's nothing here. Meaning there's nothing here to take so damn seriously. What the Buddha's teaching, what Lorna's referring to, is that there's not nothing. That's a view of annihilation. That's that view of emptiness or nothingness that the Buddha never taught. What he taught, clearly, when we understand and integrate the Eightfold Path, we recognize the ongoing process of becoming. And if it's rooted in the framework of the Eightfold Path, we will be continually becoming awakened. And if we disregard or ignore the Eightfold Path, we can only become more ignorant. That really is the essence of the Dhamma. It's the essence of eye making. Do I want to continue to become more ignorant? Hold on to this thing. And boy, I've wanted to for years. Now I take great joy that I found something that lets me get rid of this burden. And the Buddha was taught in the Arahant Sutta. He talks about letting go of the burden, putting down the burden. This is the burden. You know, this is put down the burden. We're not carrying this thing called me around anymore.
And it's not a detachment from the body. It's putting down the burden of identifying with the body.
Yeah. And then, that's right, and then you can truly be at peace with the fact that the body is prone to sickness, aging, and death. You don't get preoccupied with it, you know, when it's not that easy to get out of bed in the morning anymore. You just realize, well, I'm having this experience now because I'm grateful that I had all these years to do all these things and live this incredible life, meet these incredible people, even the ones, and I'm going back to that thought, even the people that I really had some awful times with, in that perspective, it was all part of this wonderful thing called life. Why? Because they didn't have to be any different than they did when I was upset. But now they don't. It's just part of life. It's part of this whole thing. It's part of that, you know, it's part of the great soup that we get to be a part of. It's amazing. Anyway, one of the things that is never lost on me, but tonight was a really good example. I've been in a lot of different so-called Buddhist settings, etc., a lot of different sanghas. We laugh a lot here, and it's a sure sign we got something going, you know. We laugh a lot. The whole idea, when you look at from the point of view of right view, Helen and I were talking about this maybe last week, life is absurd, and we should be able to laugh at the absurdity of life and the absurdity of our connections to that life. And we do a pretty good job of it here, so thank you all.
There's a little sub A on each one of them, and it's laugh.
Yeah, because it is. It's
pause,
and again,
laugh,
thank you, because we do it.
Again.
We do it so well here. It's wonderful.
I'm just gonna put a plug because I can't remember what that title was, but it was My Parents' Life in Pictures. Did anybody hear about that? It just was on New York Times or one of those. But a woman photographed, she was a photographer, but her parents both got cancer in their 50s, and they were quite they were madly in love with each other and very funny. And there's these amazing black and white photos and a story that goes along with it, how, and she's got no hair, and he's, you know, falling
apart. What's wrong with that?
But he was, talking. He was saying, oh my God, I had this woman and I had these kids. I was 50 years old and what an experience. And now my body's falling apart. What an experience. And there's a picture of him and she's like, yeah, skeletal. And he's back there doing something. And why he has these party hats, his boobs. And it's just, and you know,
What's it called? My Parents' Life in Pictures?
Yeah, My Parents... I can't. I'll bring it up next week.
Okay.
I'll find the title. Because it's... And the photographs are wonderful. And it's such a way to take oneself so
Yeah. It's great because it's absurd. And think about the things that I used to do. I used to be a pretty good athlete, etc. And when you're young, you really do think that this is going to be like this forever. You're always going to feel this way. And it's not. And the absurdity is thinking that way. That you just, I mean, everybody knows. I saw my parents and my grandparents. They all get old. But you never think it's going to happen to you until it does.
Or it's going to be different.
And it's wonderful that it does. Thank you, Maura. A few quick announcements. One has to do with Maura. Our Sangha picnic is Saturday the 15th. Rain date the 16th. There's info on the website and linked in the email, but if you have any questions, you can ask Maura. Do we have any questions for Maura?
You have class Saturday morning, too.
Yep. Okay. Yep. Starts around 1 o'clock, and it ends whenever. It's kind of a potluck thing, so go on the website and see, but there's some things to bring.
Yeah, but it'll be pretty small and quiet, but yeah, that's good.
Really?
Is there a grill there?
Because I invited the highwayman. So.
Yeah, there is not a grill, but if you want to help me take the grill that my mother's been trying to get me to take from her house over to, I need to transport a grill. I won't bother you, man. But maybe there's a grill. How about that?
There'll be a grill. We'll work
it
out.
We'll get it out.
I can put it in the back of the Toyota.
I know. I just had to do it.
All right, there'll be a grill, so bring some, bring stuff. Just picnic stuff, yeah, simple picnic stuff. We'll have, and it's a big property with a beautiful pool. So if you got cats and dogs and stuff that you want running around, bring them. You get to meet Bodhi too. The new book is finished.
Yeah.
It will be. And what we talked about. Thank you. That the feedback loop that we talk about is really presented in a few different ways during the book. It's kind of the underlying theme, because it's the underlying theme of the Dhamma. And I'm really pleased with the way it came out. I'm sorry for the delay, but it's finally done. The Kindle version should be available for download by Friday or Saturday. The printed book should be available to buy Monday or Tuesday. Those of you that were on retreat with us, I'll be in about 2 weeks. I'll have copies to give you to replace the proof copies that you had on retreat. So,
congratulations!
Thank you. The only thing I ask is when you've found it to be wonderful, to please review it, because I really think that I know this is going to sound very arrogant, but I think the world needs what's in there. And the best way to get that.
Are you going
to
send Trump a new copy?
I think I will. Well, I haven't heard anything about the old one, but we'll see. You never know. Yeah, look at this.
Read this first.
Sign here.
I did add one line in there where the Buddha is describing dukkha, sickness, aging, death, and I put, and Russia is dukkha, too. So maybe that'll get his attention. Oh, I'm sorry. So let's finish with the Karaniya Metta Sutta like we always do. A pure expression of an awakened human mind. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talk tonight. And metta is both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an expression of an awakened, ongoing expression of an awakened, fully mature human being. In the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta, this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.